Welcome to the A Minute to Midnight show, folks. This is Tony, coming to you from New Zealand. And on the show today, I have frequently recurring guest, John Heller. It's great to be chatting to you today, John.
Interesting time.
It sure is. There's a lot happening. And today's topic, I'll be honest, I think we're going to, there'll always be some people that are not going to be happy when we discuss this. I think two groups of people are probably not going to like us. One, the people that Donald Trump is like absolutely can do no wrong, whatever he does. And the second group is those that think Israel doesn't have a right to exist and that hate Israel. So both those two groups of people are like, you might as well hit the thumbs down button now, save yourself doing it later. And the rest of you, give us a thumbs up, it'd be great. Okay, John, so yeah, it's good to be chatting to you. What's your take on this peace plan that Donald Trump has promoted and pushed forward yesterday?
Look, I saw friends of mine sitting in the room yesterday. I actually got a text from one of them, and I think everybody's excited. This is an opportunity that Trump has taken. This plan has been in play for a long time. It's really Jared Kushner's plan. I was a little bit concerned about the way the president presented it. It was like, this is my vision. I did this. I will do that. And it just, I don't know. I just thought in the context of everything, it kind of came across as a little bit too focused on him. That was my number one. That was one of my concerns. Now, the question is this thing going to work? Well, first of all, let's talk about what it entails. It entails some pretty large land swaps, pretty much a one for one. But so Israel shrinks in size in some respects, but grows in size elsewhere, for example. But a large portion of what they're giving up to the Palestinians is land down in the Negev, which is, some people say, well, it's just desert land, but Israel is farming down there in the desert with water and everything. So I think it's, there are economic zones where the Palestinians, if they accepted the plan, they could actually make a go of it down there. So that's number one, that there's, so there's land swaps, but there's also population swaps, where a large number of Arab villages, I think 8 or 10, that are now largely or almost exclusively Arab population, that are located within Israel proper, will be shifted over to the West Bank, although I think the residents will be given an opportunity to either keep Israeli citizenship or have some kind of a residency status. But in some respects, it's sort of a shift in population. If all of the Arab population moved into the new Palestinian state, it would have an impact somewhat on the demographics of Israel. Some of the key features, there will be a Palestinian capital. This is all assuming the Palestinians would accept it. And they've already now come out and said no, 10,000 times no. Abbas hates it. Abbas referred to Trump as a dog and the son of a dog. And we know that in Islamic culture, a dog is, you know, sort of a very unclean animal. So to refer to the president as a dog is a pretty big insult. But let's just assume, play, you know, fantasy island thing here, and so assume that the Palestinians accept it. So East Jerusalem would be a capital, but it would only be neighborhoods in Jerusalem, municipality, that are east of the separation wall, the apartheid wall that is referred to by the Christ at the Checkpoint and pro-Palestinian crowd. It would be mainly the neighborhoods of Abu Dis and a couple others that are sort of located to the east and north of the old city of Jerusalem. The old city of Jerusalem, the city of David, and that type of thing would be under Israeli control and sovereignty. The Temple Mount would still, they keep saying that they're going to do status quo on the Temple Mount. Now, exactly what status quo in the Temple Mount is something that's really open for debate even without this plan, because we see the Palestinians and the Jordanians, it's really administered by the King of Jordan through the Islamic Waqf in Jerusalem. They're building a new mosque at the Golden Gate, even though they said they wouldn't. They previously, over the last 10 or so years, had built a couple of massive underground mosques, one of which can accommodate, I believe, at one time, 35,000 worshipers. It's a huge underground facility there to the, it would be towards the Mount of Olives. So be a little bit east of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock. So the status quo at the Temple Mount will be supposedly kept the same. Now, there's been recent incidents where Jewish settlers and others have been going up on the Temple Mount and actually praying, and they've been getting away with it without getting arrested. But David Friedman, the U.S. ambassador, came out and said, no, there'll be no Christian praying or no Jewish praying up on the Temple Mount. So that's one area where I think if you look at the plan, whether you like it or not, the status quo of the Temple Mount is a area where I think they fudged heavily in the plan. The other place where they fudged heavily was the statement that the right of return of Palestinian refugees would be the subject of future negotiations. This is a highly controversial area. There's no way that Israel would agree to the right of return. This is something that I've discussed with people that are Palestinians, and especially, you know, and I think King Abdullah of Jordan, he likes it. He would like the right of return because over half of his population in Jordan is Palestinian, and they don't have full rights there. Just like the people that live in Judea and Samaria or the West Bank, they don't have full rights in Israel to vote in Israeli elections. There are restrictions on Palestinians in Jordan. There are even more restrictions on Palestinians to the extent that there are any left in Syria. So the belief has been, well, they're just going to eventually get to return to Israel, and there'll be 2-4 million Palestinians returned to Israel. They will then have demographic control over everything. They'll be able to control the Israeli government if there was a one-state solution. So the Trump administration plan, at least my initial read-through, was they punted on the issue of the right of return. But Israel's never going to agree to it. So that on other areas, though, there were some interesting provisions. For example, holy sites that are now within the area of the West Bank under Palestinian control, and having been there just a couple of years ago, when you go into those areas, it said this is Area A. Israeli citizens are strictly prohibited from coming in. That would be areas like Nablus, where the ancient city of Shechem is, Joshua's Altar up on Mount Ebal, and the city of Shechem, and then Joseph's tomb there in Nablus. And when we were there, we couldn't even go to the Joseph's tomb. Right now, the Jewish people can go there to worship at Joseph's tomb, not to pray to Joseph, but to remember what he meant to them. They're allowed like one time a month at 2 o'clock in the morning. They take them under heavy military guard. They will have more access to that site. There will also be greater access to the tomb of the patriarchs in Hebron. So that's a pretty significant difference. And then, of course, then the major archaeological site in the city of David would be under Israeli control. So that's sort of the general nature of the plan. There's some conditions. You know, the Palestinians have to say, we agree to a Jewish state. We won't challenge a Jewish state. We demilitarize. We get rid of Hamas, that type of thing. Some of the more interesting provisions of the plan, and if you have a map of it, it helps to look at this. So what they will do in the West Bank is they will have Palestinian areas, and there's they have two maps in the plan. They're conceptual maps. They're working on much more highly detailed maps that would really get down to the house and street level. But the conceptual maps right now, there's one for the state of Israel, and then there's one for a future state of Palestine. So I've seen a lot of people saying that, well, Trump is really not dividing the land. But in a sense, he is. He's made up a map for a state of Palestine. And this is kind of a big deal, because the fact that Netanyahu and Gantz have said that they would accept this, this is really sort of a step down the road that they're recognizing, potentially recognizing, a future Palestinian state. And this is something that the Israeli governments have been pretty rigid about not recognizing in the past. They talk about it, but they've never really recognized it. And they actually recognize certain specific borders for this new Palestinian state. In the Palestinian state, there's a series of roads that will be exclusively Palestinian. The infrastructure for Israeli roads through this area is already pretty much in place. There's a lot of, the roads are separate. It's like two separate road systems when you drive through there. And if you have an Israeli license plate on your car, you could drive on certain roads, but Palestinians cannot. Now, there are ways to get around checkpoints and that type of thing. If you know how the roads work, there are overpasses, underpasses, but there are little ways to kind of work your way around it. But when they want to lock down the West Bank, which they did to a large degree when we were there because Trump was visiting and the Palestinians were kind of fired up in 2017, they just come in and they just lock the road system down. And it's very, very difficult to navigate up through down into Judea and up into Samaria. So the roads will be even more separate than they are now. And there's a series of bridges, tunnels. They're proposing a tunnel that will go from Gaza Strip to around Hebron. That's about 35 kilometers. It will be the sixth longest bridge or tunnel in the world. And it'll be covered in some fashion for security reasons. But it will allow movement between, but it will be filled with checkpoints, and it'll allow some movement, though, between Gaza and the Palestinian state, which really doesn't exist right now. So it's a very, very highly, I mean, they really did a lot of detailed work on this, and it'll be interesting to see when they come out with the detailed plans exactly what it looks like. The other thing that's interesting is that it really recognizes Israel's right to certain, like the Jordan Valley and other things that they've wanted for a long time, and then the settlements that are already built in Judea and Samaria. There's a provision that the settlements will not be expanded for like 48 months from yesterday. The Palestinians have to meet certain conditions. Israel's allowed to do some annexation almost immediately. In fact, I think there's a bill pending in front of the Knesset right now to vote on that. So I will say this, the plan goes much further than any plan has before. Oslo was, you know, a big step down the road to this division and the two-state solution, but it didn't do anything near what the Trump plan does. The plan's also designed to sort of build up the Palestinian economic situation, double their GDP, reduce their unemployment rate by half. So it's a pretty bold plan. So then the question is, what has the response been? Let me just cover that real quickly. The Palestinians have rejected it. Gantz and Netanyahu seem to be on board. Jared Kushner, who's really the architect of the plan and the driving force behind it, has said, listen, the Palestinians can't screw up. If they don't accept this, they've screwed it up again. Of course, that's been met with some pretty harsh commentary in the press, that he would have the audacity to actually speak the truth about what's going on. You know, the old saying of the one of the first, I think the first foreign minister of Israel was Abba Ibn, very interesting guy back in the 50s and 60s. And he said, the Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And that's been true. They've really made a lot of mistakes. So Palestinians hate it. They're not going to accept it. There are big demonstrations going on in Israel as we speak. There is concern that Friday prayers at the Temple Mount and Al-Aqsa Mosque will have riots associated with them.
Jared Kushner, according to an interview with Al Jazeera, he said the Palestinian Authority would rather go and complain as opposed to come to the table and negotiate, which quite frankly shows that they are not ready to have a state. Those are Kushner's words.
Yeah, I mean, and it's true. They refuse to negotiate. And part of this is economic on their part. Their incessant complaining, I guess I would, is the kind way to put it. It brings them money. They have people that give them money. Now, other reactions have been kind of interesting. I saw a gentleman on German YouTube channel, DW, who was involved with the Palestinian negotiations about 30 years ago during the Oslo process. His reaction was, okay, Trump, I'll tell you what, we're not going to accept your deal. And in fact, what we're going to do, this is what I've told the Palestinians to do for 10 years or more now, is abolish the Palestinian Authority and make Israel, okay, Israel, you want to control this land? Fine. We're calling your bluff. You can provide all the security. You can provide all the police and that sort of thing in the area of the West Bank. And we will overwhelm you at the box off or at the ballot box. We will control the future of Israeli politics because we have many more people than you do. Now, personally, Tony, I'm more of the view espoused by people like Yoram Edinger and Caroline Glick that I don't think, assuming there's no right of return, I'm not convinced that the demographics favor the Palestinians if they made it into a one state. When I was in some of the areas of the West Bank, we were in neighborhoods, beautiful homes and that type of thing, but they were totally empty during the day. And talking to people there, this is a problem that people have homes there, but they live someplace else and they're never there. They've moved to America or whatever. So I'm not sure that a one-state solution would be a demographic disaster for Israel. That's a very controversial area. But this Palestinian, pro-Palestinian negotiator just says, well, look, let's just abandon the Palestinian Authority and make Israel control everything, and we'll show them that they don't want the one-state solution. Now, Caroline Glick came out. She has an article at Israel Hayom today. I respect her a lot. I think she's a good thinker. She's a Zionist, though. She was born and raised in Chicago, went to Harvard and Columbia, and then made Aliyah to Israel in her early 20s, was in the Israeli military for a while, spokesperson for the IDF, also worked with Netanyahu. But really, I think one of the more respected thinkers on this topic. And he says, listen, what Trump did yesterday, she goes, was historic. This was a great shift in the history of the state of Israel. She says this, that Truman had a view that, well, the Jews were just these poor refugees and we need to help them out and they'll never amount to much of anything. And it really wasn't the American views, the majority views in America didn't really shift until around the time of the Six-Day War in 1967. So that this is a huge, big difference in the way the American government views the state of Israel, what happened yesterday. And in that sense, it was a story. And so if you support Israel, that is a big deal. She says this. It is far from clear that the leaders of the Israeli communities in Judea and Samaria understand the significance of Trump's actions. On Tuesday, Trump recognized the truth at the foundation of Zionism and made that truth the foundation of America's policy regarding the Palestinian conflict with Israel. Trump is a true friend of the Jewish people. He didn't offer us a perfect plan, but he offered us a plan that we can live with. That alone sets it apart from all American plans that preceded it. It would be a sin for us not to support it. Netanyahu pledged to apply Israeli law to the Jordan Valley and the Israeli communities in Judea and Samaria on Sunday. Every Jew in Israel and worldwide should expect that he and his ministers will fulfill this pledge. And every Jew in Israel and worldwide should feel thankful for Trump, for his friendship, and for his courage to embrace the truth. So that's the view of someone who lives in one of the settler communities in Judea. And I would say that that's probably pretty true across the board among those settler communities, what Caroline and Glick expressed in their article. Now, another article that sort of presents a different view is David Ignatius in the Washington Post today. His op-ed is titled, "The Trump Peace Plan is a Squeeze Play Against the Palestinians, and it Might Just Work." He says, throughout the dense text of the peace plan, and it's about 181 pages with appendices, that President Trump announced on Tuesday is a stark but unstated question to the Palestinians. If you reject this deal as bad as you think it may be, what are you going to get instead? The phrase "take it or leave it" doesn't convey the sharp edge of Trump's demand. He is telling the Palestinians that after three decades of rejecting better offers than this one, they're in danger of being abandoned by the Arabs. Now, that brings up one of the other sort of interesting reactions. The plan was totally rejected by Turkey and Iran. And it's interesting that the people that reject this plan are the people that we know are sort of involved in the coalition at the end that comes up and attacks Israel. I'm talking about the Ezekiel 38-39 war. We don't know exactly when that happens. You know, there's a lot of controversy. I won't go into that controversy now. But two of the major players in that reject the plan. There were diplomatic representatives at the announcement yesterday from some other countries, I believe the United Arab Emirates and Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and one of the other Sunni countries have sort of expressed a tacit approval of what's going on. The Saudi Arabia statement was essentially, we think this is, we think the further negotiations should begin immediately, and we have a framework in which those can be conducted. And so the change among the some of these Sunni Arab states, I mean, we already have sort of a peace agreement between Jordan and Israel and between Egypt and Israel, but bringing in the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates and some other of the Sunni Arab countries is this is a big game changer that they would actually sort of participate in these negotiations. So that's a major shift. Now, I don't know that that shift means that they love Israel or the state of Israel. There was a little bit that was sort of buried in the news last week, a little bit of a controversy between Israel and Saudi Arabia. Israeli Interior Minister, Foreign Minister came out and said, hey, Israel people can now go to Saudi Arabia. All they have to do is get a visa. Well, the person in charge of tourism or passports or visas in Saudi Arabia came out and said, no. Jewish people aren't welcome here. So there's still a bit of a tension on that level. But in the background, there seems to be some diplomatic things going on that shows an improvement in Israel-Sunni Arab relations. But I don't know if it's based on the fact that they really respect Israel. It may be that they're frustrated with the Palestinians and they view Israel as a help in keeping back the what they view as a coming onslaught from Turkey or Iran. So I think that's probably more likely, is that it's a they're being very pragmatic in the way they're approaching it. I don't think there's been a shift in what they say. My personal concern is that I think the peace plan orientation is very naive. in dealing with the sort of globalist domination worldview of Islam, I don't think it recognizes that reality. But that's probably a problem of every government on the planet now. But this Trump plan certainly doesn't go into that, or doesn't address that issue very well, in my opinion.
Interesting. That's a pretty good analysis of it. I'm just thinking, because I know there'll be people, I mean, all the time, that don't like Israel, that even listen to the show and, you know, cop a lot of comments and stuff. But as much as I try and have a balanced view on it all and don't think that Israel is perfect in any shape or form, some things I don't like about it. I do believe in Israel's right to exist. I believe that biblically it has the right to exist. And, you know, it doesn't mean I support everything. I'm not a fan of the Rothschilds and so on. And when I know they've had a big part to play in the setting up of the state of Israel and so on. But I'm also just, you know, I do get frustrated with the people that are so anti, well, they call themselves anti-Zionist, but really, for the most part, they just hate Israel and don't like Jews. That's the frank fact about it. And the ones that believe that Christians are the true Israel and that God has no plan for Israel in the future and that the Old Testament has no bearing on today, well, those people I know that listen to this show, I just want to address a few things to them now. Genesis 17:8, all the land of Canaan where you are now, where you now live as strangers, I'll give to you and your descendants for an everlasting possession. I'll be their God. It says now, Joel 3:1-2, for behold, in those days and at that time I'll bring back the captives of Judah and Jerusalem. I will also gather all nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat, and I will enter into judgment with them there on account of my people, my heritage, Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations, and they have divided up my land. Joel 3:1-2. Now, you mentioned Trump's plan. Well, in a sense, it is dividing up the land if it goes ahead. So now I just want to move on. Zechariah 12:12. This is definitely end time scriptures, folks. So those that don't believe the Old Testament has any bearing today, or that there is no bearing for Israel and the Jews in the end times, listen to to these things. Okay, this is Zechariah 12:3. And it shall happen in that day that I will make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. All who would heave it away will surely be cut in pieces, though all the nations of the earth are gathered against it. Now, we haven't got all the nations of the earth gathered against it yet, but I think that's coming. Verse 9, that was verse 3. It shall be in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. Verse 10, and I will pour on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication. Then they will look on me whom they pierced. Yes, they will mourn for him as one mourns for his only son, and grieve for him as one grieves for a firstborn. In that day there shall be a great mourning in Jerusalem like the mourning at Hadad Rimmon in the plain of Megiddo, which is Armageddon. And many people believe the valley of Jehoshaphat in Joel 3:1-2 is also talking about Armageddon. Okay, so these are obvious references to the end times. Those that claim today that Israel and the Jews have no relevance to scripture today, to those that claim that Christians are the true Israel and not the Jews, to those that say God has no plan for modern Israel and the Jews today, I ask you this question. If it's Christians who are descendants of the house of David, remember verse 10 there, and I will pour out on the house of David, right? So if it's Christians who are the descendants of the house of David, why would we be looking on him whom we pierced and mourning? Did Christians crucify Jesus? No. Who are the descendants of David that are in Jerusalem to mourn him whom they've pierced at the return of Jesus? it's obvious it has to be the Jews. It can't be anyone else. So there are so much more I could go into, but I just wanted to say that. So, John, I'll leave it to you now.
No,
I will have angered that. Some people, I know, but that's the facts. Face it, folks. Ask yourself that very question. Read those scriptures and ask yourself how else you could interpret it. I don't believe there's any other way.
Right, and I would throw in like Ezekiel chapter 36, Romans chapter 11. You know, and Ezekiel 36 says that, you know, you're going to be scattered among the nations, and in the end, I'm going to bring you back. I'm going to bring you back, and the clear implication is they're brought back in unbelief. And because it says, I will bring you back, then I will give you a new heart, and you will turn to God. So this is, I think, a great promise, and I've often said that if you think God's forever promises to the Jews can be done away with so easily, why would you then believe God's forever promises to you as a believer in Christ? But, you know, look, it all happens through Christ. So I think that...
neither of us are saying that we believe that Jews are saved or that, you know, that that's okay if you're a Jew, that's as good as being a Christian. You're just as lost if you're a Jew that doesn't know Jesus as if you're a Gentile that doesn't know Jesus. But that's a whole separate issue because, yeah, God, I do believe, has a plan to bring them. Well, they have been brought back. And I know that there are people that will claim, no, they haven't. They're just fake Khazars and... That's a whole other thing, which I don't agree with. But anyway,
I hear it all the time. It's sort of like I thought your video, by the way, that you did on the Albert Pike prophecy or writing or whatever plan or whatever. I thought that was very well done.
Thanks, John.
It's a concern that I've had. It's I see these theories propagating over the internet all the time that I don't think are very much based in fact. And I just think people need to do a little bit better research on their own. So I'm not saying that some of the things people say are not true. I'm just saying as I try to be very careful and reasoned and measured in the things that I talk about. So the other question, Tony, and I know we want to keep this short, so just let me briefly say this. So the big question that I see running around the different Facebook groups and prophecy groups and stuff that I belong to is this the covenant of Daniel chapter 9? Is this the covenant that begins the 70th week? And so my answer is, I don't think so. But I think this is a good time for the church to have a very detailed conversation done in love with everybody about what is the covenant that's referenced in Daniel chapter 9. I know there's a theory among a large portion of the eschatology community that we will know who the Antichrist is. People will know who the Antichrist is because of this, whoever it is that enters into this covenant. But my question would be, let's just play a what if. What if the thing that Trump announced yesterday is the covenant? Who's the Antichrist? Was the Antichrist in the room? And so I think that this is sort of a problematic thing that I don't think it's going to be quite that clear, even when the actual event covenant happens, that this is really the thing, because I don't think the true revelation of the Antichrist takes place until he would go into the temple and declare himself above all that is called God. And that event happens in the middle of a future 70th week. So I don't hold to the view that the identification of the man of sin, the son of perdition, happens when the covenant is signed. I think some people will know, but I don't think it's going to be readily apparent. When he goes into the temple and does that publicly, there'll be no question then. So, but I think it would be a great idea for the eschatology community, the futurist premillennial eschatology community, to have a conversation about that now, because I talk on this a lot. I talk to other people. I hear what they say. I listen to other people. And I'm just going to tell you, there are a lot of different views about what is the covenant that's confirmed to start the 70th week. There is not unanimity of an opinion on that at all. So maybe this is a good time to have people sit down and have that conversation and come to maybe a little bit better understanding.
Good point. Yeah.
So that's my view. But look, I don't know if this is the thing of the 70th week. I could see some future Antichrist picking this up and saying it. I think the word there in Daniel 9:27, he will confirm. It's the word gabar. It's a word that also sort of associated with force and prevailing. So I'm not so sure that it's something that Israel, it may be forced on them, for all I know. I mean, I think that's a reasonable interpretation of that. So I don't know that it's an agreement for an agreement between Israel and the Palestinians. At some point, Tony, I've watched this for a lot of years. Understand the Palestinians have reached a point, they're out of patience. They want something done. They want something done.
But they've pretty much stated, and Abbas has stated, that they won't accept anything less than all of Jerusalem as their capital. So anything else they're going to reject. Look, but they're never going to get that. Yeah. You know?
And this morning in Tel Aviv, there were protests at one of the universities in Tel Aviv. I saw the videos. The pro-Palestinian students running around saying, from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free. They want to eliminate the state of Israel. So that's sort of what they say. But I also think that with the security situation and having, as I said, spent some time in the area of Judea, Samaria, the West Bank, a couple of years ago, and going to a place like Hebron, the division in that land is just, it's incredible. And the fact that there's some successful economic stories coming out of that when they have the security situation that they do is just incredible. But I think that Israel is getting tired of the issue too. So, you know, I think we're getting to a tipping point where it's going to go one way or the other. And I think the Arabs themselves in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, they're also losing patience with the Palestinians. So I think David Ignatius' column, I don't agree with much David Ignatius says, but I think he made some good points here, is that this plan is pretty much, listen, Palestinians, you're at a take it or leave it point. And you better make the right decision or else you're going to have big problems. So, and it may be that they don't do it, and Israel has to deal with the issue on a larger scale than they have thus far. And that's not to say that there aren't good people among in the Palestinian areas, but their leadership is just totally corrupt. It's the huge homes that the leadership has that I've seen in Ramallah and elsewhere are just absolutely incredible. And then these people are, after 70 years, they're still forcing them to live in refugee camps. Why are people living in these homes that look like homes in Beverly Hills, Arab homes in the West Bank, and then you drive down the road and there's a refugee camp where people live in squalor and have for over 70 years now? Why can't they let their people, why can't they within their own community get these people out of there? It's just, it's unconscionable in my view. They're political pawns.
Yeah, that's a good, very good point. Yeah, just one other thing I just want to say. I know there are still people that everything Donald Trump does shows that he's the Antichrist to those people. And then there are other people that everything Donald Trump says, what a great man he is, the best president we've ever had. And he's doing, I mean, I just see totally the opposites. And I just kind of want to say to both people on both camps, don't be so blinded that you can't actually look at everything that he does objectively. Take away your blinders on either end of that and just look at the things and realize that Donald Trump is a politician and politicians do what politicians do and they have reasons for it. And there's money that calls in behind the scenes as well. He's not his own man to just do as he pleases. There's forces behind Donald Trump as well. So, yeah, just take your blinders off and look at things objectively and realize that we are in the end times and things are heading towards a climax. We don't know how quickly it's going to happen or how slowly, really. We can just see all the pieces are starting to fall into place and just try and have a balanced view on it. And trust God anyway. That's the most important thing.
And I've been doing this for a long time, probably over 20 years now. I've been looking at current events and that type of thing. And I will tell you that the thing that I did at Fellowship Bible Chapel last Sunday, my prophecy update, I think I titled it Stress Test. I'm not a fearful person by nature. I figure, I'm in the hand of, as a Christian believer, I'm in God's hand and protection, and he will do what he will with my life. And my sincere hope is that whatever I do would glorify God, however it works out. But I will say that last Sunday, it was just sort of, with everything going on, coronavirus in China and the situation in the Middle East and the political turmoil here and everywhere, it seems, it was a pretty difficult talk to give, because I'm concerned where things are going. I think we're at or past or very, very close to a tipping point, that where once we get past that point, things will not go backwards. And we may be past it already. I don't know. In some respects, I think we have. So, listen, we need to know that ultimately God's in control of all this, that all of these things that we know that are prophesied to happen and unfold will happen in God's timing and for his glory and to prove his word and who he is. And so I want to always keep that in mind. But, we talked before we said today, Kobe Bryant's a good example. There's a guy who had everything, success, money, fame, family and everything, and he got in a helicopter to go to a basketball game with his daughter. And I'm sure he planned on coming home and doing the same thing for the next 20, 30, 40 years. And life is very fragile. We have no guarantees, any one of us. And we need to always live that, your life, with eternity in mind and make sure that we're right with God.
Brilliant way to finish. Well, thanks, John. It's been an interesting discussion, and I've certainly learned a lot about what things I didn't know from the peace plan. So thank you again. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks, Tony, so much. Appreciate it.
Folks, if you're not one of those that's already disliked this video, we'd appreciate it if you would like it and share it. And all of our videos, you can find them on YouTube, on aminutetomidnight.com, and also we put this out as audio on iTunes. Just a heads up too, that A Minute to Midnight is run 100% by donations, and folks, we really appreciate it. If you could help us out, things have been quite slow of late, so anybody that wants to donate to us, and well, I do really appreciate those that do, and if you want to join them, you can do that at aminutetomidnight.com. You can find ways to donate there. Really can't keep this show running without people's help. It's a full-time job, so I won't say any more than that, but thank you for those that are helping. The music that I've used in the shows, I've written, played and recorded, and if you want to download music, you can find that at our website as well. We also have a forum on the website and a Facebook group as well. That's it for this show. We'll be back very soon in another day or two with another episode of the A Minute to Midnight show. God bless and have a great week.